This meeting of the Health, Housing, and Family Security Committee will come to order. I want to start out with a couple of reminders or notices for people. One is we do like to start meetings a little more promptly than this, so please encourage people to get here on time. And then also want to remind members that immediately after this committee in this room, we're having a joint hearing, joint meeting with State and Local Government Committee on compulsive gambling. This committee has jurisdiction over compulsive gambling. That committee has jurisdiction over gambling. So there's a presentation here at 3 o'clock today on that, and I'd encourage members of the committee to stay around for that. Then we are having a hearing on this Friday at 12:30 p.m., and also next Monday and Wednesday, in addition to the daytime meetings, we're having evening hearings. Monday and Wednesday. And perhaps one on Friday next week if we still need to. So we do have to be out of this room before 3 o'clock. We have to have this committee wrapped up so we can begin the joint committee with state and local. With that, bring up Senate File 1095.
Did she just give this to you? Senator Marty, whenever you're ready, go right ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 1095.
And do you have an amendment to offer?
There is an amendment, an A07 something something amendment.
0198.
Yes.
And Senator Marty, you've got a typo in line 11 of the first page.
There's a Y missing in
fix
there.
Fix that.
With the corrected spelling, I will move the amendment.
Okay. All in favor? Please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Adopted. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this bill would provide early hearing detection and intervention for Minnesota. And this may sound like a small issue. Right now, Minnesota does screenings for newborns with a blood spot, which results about 100 babies per year are screened for things that where we are able to intervene and prevent either sometimes fatal but at least permanently disabling conditions. We can address them through early intervention. It affects about 100 children a year. This one additional test that we would be proposing to add to it would identify about 240 children a year with hearing loss. And that's very important because the research suggests that if we screen a child at birth and get them services they need for hearing by age 6 months, they are going to be up with their peers in school and reading and so on. They're going to be fully caught up with their peers. However, if we wait till about age 3 or so when we might normally catch that, they are not going to be reading at their reading level. They're going to be special education students. There's a lot of loss to the student, to the child, and the first 3 years are critically important. Minnesota is not one of the best states in this. We are rated by the CDC as unsatisfactory, and apparently we're one of the 5 worst states in terms of identifying and reporting infant hearing loss. And this bill would require that all birthing hospitals screen at birth. It would be added to the blood spot test that's done. And there'd be infrastructure set up in place to do follow-up tracking and make sure that the children get the services they need. The costs would come from lab fees that would be added to the blood spot form. I believe the 53 conditions we screen for now is about $61 per test for the test. This would add, I'm told, we don't have a fiscal note, but I'm told perhaps $15, $20 more for one test. But remember, that catches 100 children a year. This would catch 240 additional children, several times the results we catch from all the blood spot tests. And I'm very pleased today that we have Dr. Carl White here to testify. He's a professor of psychology and chair of the research and evaluation methodology graduate program at Utah State. He's the founding director of the National Center for Hearing Assessment and Management. He's conducted numerous research projects and published extensively in this area. He's sort of the national expert in this area and a consultant for the Center for Disease Control He flew in here very early in the morning, is staying around yesterday for a hearing in the House and staying around today so that he can make the presentation to us as well. Again, this is one additional test to the 53 we already do, but those 53 catch a total of about 100 infants needing intervention. This would catch about 240 additional ones. With that, I'd like to introduce Dr. Carl White.
Dr. White, welcome to our committee. That sure is a cute baby up there in your presentation.
It is a cute baby. And thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm very happy to be here to speak in support of this bill. The baby you see on the screen here is what we would like to have happen with all children who are born with hearing loss. You'll notice that she's wearing a hearing aid, and this baby was identified when she was 2 weeks old, fit with a hearing aid. And because of that, her chances of developing normal speech and language and being successful in school are much, much higher than what happens with most children. This is a picture of Alexander Graham Bell working with Helen Keller. Most of you will know that Helen Keller was both deaf and blind. And in spite of that, she overcame great obstacles to be a very successful woman. Later in her life, she was once asked whether the condition of blindness or deafness was a more serious obstacle to overcome. And her answer surprised a lot of people and I think summarizes very well why this is such an important bill. She said, "Blindness is not nearly as devastating as deafness." And the reason she gave was that blindness separated me from things, but deafness separated me from people. And it's this ability to communicate with other people which is at the very heart of why we want to do newborn hearing screening and intervention programs. I'd like to play a short video clip, and we've had a little trouble with the speaker, so I would ask you in the room to be quiet to make sure that you can hear this. This is the typical response of a parent whose child is identified with hearing loss. Most children with hearing loss are born to normally hearing parents who have no experience with this condition.
By the time she was a year old, we were going for her well child checkup and asked our pediatrician. But he couldn't really tell. He didn't have any answers for us. I cried right away. I was just shocked, and I didn't know what to do. I'd never met a deaf person, and I didn't even know what to expect. We called back the next day and said, "Well, does that mean she won't talk? What does that really mean?" And we wanted to communicate. We were heartbroken, not that she was deaf, so much as that we didn't know how to communicate with her.
Now, there's three take-home messages I'd like you to get from that videotape. The first is that the vast majority of parents who have children born with hearing loss don't know what to expect. They're looking for help, and they desperately need help to know how to interact with and how to help this child achieve their potential. The second is that because the technology in this field has changed so rapidly, which I'll show you in just a moment, many of the professionals who are responsible for serving these children don't know what can be done with them and don't have as high of expectations as they could have. So a very important part of the bill you're considering would be education to help those people become more aware. And thirdly, was summarized in her statement when she said, "We were heartbroken, not that she was deaf, but that we didn't know how to communicate with her." So finding ways to help families communicate with their children is at the very essence of why we want to do newborn hearing screening. Now, hearing loss is not well known. It is the most frequent birth defect in the United States, as Senator Marty pointed out. If you had a population of 10,000 children born, about 30 of those would have permanent hearing loss, compared to 11 of them with Down syndrome, or one of them with phenylketonuria, which is one of the conditions you screen for now in your blood spot screening. So hearing loss is 30 times as frequent as PKU, or as Senator Marty pointed out, 2.5 times as frequent as all of the conditions that you screen for now in the blood spot screening. It's often referred to as an invisible handicap because children who are born with permanent hearing loss for the first few months of life look and act completely normally. They should be developing language during that time, but they don't begin to emerge with that language typically until they're about 12 months old. But the fact that they're not getting auditory input during that time means that there are connections that should be being made in the brain that begin to atrophy and will never be made unless we get auditory input to them during that first few months of life. If we're able to identify this hearing loss early, then there's dramatic benefits associated with it. If not, then these children will have a lifetime of special education requirements that become very expensive. The Centers for Disease Control estimate that for each of these children it will cost an additional $500,000 per year or per lifetime of that child to educate them and to try and help them achieve acceptable levels. In spite of that extra education, though, we historically have not been very successful in helping them to achieve success in school or in society later. Before we had newborn hearing screening in this country, people who were born deaf at that time, the average deaf adult in this country reads at about the fourth grade level, in spite of spending tens of thousands of dollars per year per child on helping them learn to read better. Now, of course, there are some deaf people who are able to overcome those obstacles, have postgraduate degrees, and are very successful. But on average, deaf children who are not identified early will never attain beyond about the fourth grade level in reading. 95% of all children who are born deaf are born to typically hearing parents. And this creates a situation where it's very difficult to know how to intervene with these children. Historically, the main mode of communication has been sign language, and that still remains a very appropriate mode for those families who choose it. But because of recent technology, there are many of these children who are able to develop spoken language in a way that enables them to communicate much more successfully with their families. I'm going to play you a video clip now of a little girl from this class who was born in 1970, and this represents what we used to be able to do 30 years ago with those families who wanted their children to have spoken language. Listen carefully and see if you can understand. Now, I suspect most of you didn't understand that. What you've just listened to is what we often call deaf speech. And I'm going to play it once more and give you a visual hint this time. Okay, so imagine that you had a deaf child, and this was the best that they were able to communicate using spoken language. Now, again, sign language is another option for some families, but many families, because their native language is spoken English, want their children to be able to speak and to listen as they do. And this was about the best we were able to do 30 years ago. I'm going to play another clip now of a little girl who was born in 2002, who had the advantage of early identification and of the newer technology which is now available. This little clip I'm going to play is actually a girl with a much more severe hearing loss. She has what we call profound hearing loss, so no hearing at all. But she was identified when she was 2 weeks old, received a cochlear implant when she was about a year old, and then was enrolled in the kinds of early intervention services that this bill will help to organize.
Three blind mice. See how they run. They all ran after the farmer's wife, who cut off their tails with a carving knife. Did you ever see such a thing in your life? Asked three blind mice. Hello, my name is Samantha Davidson. I'm 4, and I love to make crafts.
Okay, so what enabled us to move from where we were 30 years ago to where we are today? It's exactly the kinds of things that this bill is talking about. Earlier identification of hearing loss as a result of universal newborn hearing screening programs. At this point in time, 95% of all babies in this country are being screened for hearing loss before they leave the hospital. Here in Minnesota, that number is about 85%. This bill would enable it to reach 100%. But just as important is the availability of better assistive listening devices, hearing aids, cochlear implants, FM systems that allow us to provide that auditory input to children. At the same time, the development of better early intervention programs that know how to teach language to these children so that for those who choose a spoken language option, they can develop that language at an appropriate age and be on level with their classmates. Now, some children will also want to use sign language for a variety of reasons. Those children are also benefited by earlier identification and by the enrollment in these kinds of early intervention programs. And then finally, the development of advocacy and public policy programs, much like you're considering here, that require newborn hearing screening as a part of the public health system and enable these children to be enrolled in programs that provide these sorts of outcomes for them. In 1993, the National Institutes of Health recommended that all children in this country be screened for hearing loss before they leave the hospital. We've been a long time in reaching the point where now 95% of children are screened. But because of those programs, we're beginning to have the kinds of impacts that you saw in these video clips. The number of children identified per 1,000 in states that have been doing this for some time are about 3 to 4 children per 1,000, which translates into the 240 children per year that Senator Marty talked about. You've been screening here in Minnesota for the last 5 years, but you aren't identifying nearly as many children. And that's because even though you're screening 85% of the babies, the system isn't integrated into the existing diagnostic and intervention system. So it doesn't make sense to screen babies, even at the 85% level, unless they're connected with the services that they need to achieve the kinds of things that you've seen here. And that needs to be, then, a complete system of screening, diagnosis, intervention programs, all of which need to be coordinated with the existing healthcare system, what we call the medical home. There needs to be a data management and tracking system that sets up a safety net so that children really get the services that they need. And that tracking system needs to feed into a program evaluation and quality assurance system. And all of that needs to be done in a context that families get the kinds of education and support that they need. And part of what's before the legislature this session is components that will do all of those things in addition to the mandate for screening, which is being considered in this bill. I'd like to play one final video clip that I think summarizes why this is so important from a parent's perspective. You're not hearing anything.
We had the time to make...
Okay, let me start it again.
Early identification meant for us time was on our side, as it isn't, and for so many families. We had the time to make choices about communication styles early. So time was given to us that is stolen from other families merely because they don't have their child screened.
So this bill provides an opportunity for all families in Minnesota to not only have their children screened and have that early identification, but also to receive the other services that will enable their children to truly achieve their full potential. So I'm here today to speak in favor of this bill and hope that you will help babies here in Minnesota here and now so that they can achieve the things that they're capable of achieving. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. White. Questions for Dr. White? If not, Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, we have Nicole Mathis here.
Welcome to our committee, Ms. Mathis.
Thank you. First, I'll introduce my two children. This is Justin, who's 7 years old and wears hearing aids. And this is Joey, who's 4, who also wears hearing aids.
Would you pull the microphone just a little closer to you, please?
I'm here to testify about the importance of hearing detection and intervention for children and their families. I have a wonderful husband and 3 very precious children, 2 which have moderate to severe hearing loss. My 7-year-old son, Justin, was born on July 19, 1999, in St. Paul, Minnesota, at United Hospital. Newborn hearing screenings were not being routinely conducted at the hospital at this time. Justin had the characteristics of a normal child up until he was about 3 years old. He had been having several ear infections, and we noticed a speech delay and the television being turned up all of the time. The doctors told us not to worry about it, especially because my husband, Dave, didn't start talking until he was 4. We went in for Justin's 3-year wellness checkup in July of 2002, which included a hearing test. A nurse conducted a behavioral test where Justin dropped toy blocks into a basket upon hearing a sound. He failed this test, but because he had some fluid in his ears, we were asked to return a month later. Justin failed the hearing test for a second time. We discussed options with his pediatrician. At that point, I had become very frustrated and asked if he would give us a referral to a ears, nose, and throat specialist. He gave us the referral, and we proceeded down this path. We met with the ENT and an audiologist who indicated that Justin was not hearing in the normal frequency range. His ears contained fluid, and tubes were done in December of 2003. After 3 weeks, he was tested again, and his hearing was still below normal. The ENT indicated that Justin had an atypical low-frequency hearing loss. Most children have hearing loss in the high frequencies. At this point, the ENT wanted to keep an eye on him, so he asked that we come back in 3 months to have another hearing test done before he started kindergarten. When this time came to go back, the audiologist performed a hearing test, and it showed that he still had the same loss, and it had not gotten worse. The ENT and the audiologist advised us to get Justin fitted for hearing aids. They thought it would be better to start him out early rather than waiting until he was in third grade and falling behind in school. My husband, David, and I agreed and had Justin fitted that day and placed our order. We also encountered issues with the insurance coverage. The company I worked for at the time was self-insured, and they did not cover hearing aids, and it did not fall under the Minnesota law requiring children under the age of 18 with hearing loss to have coverage. Luckily, we had double coverage, and my husband's plan covered his hearing aids at 80 and 20%. The other problem we faced partially due to Justin's hearing loss was selective mutism. By definition, selective mutism is characterized by a consistent failure to speak in specific social situations in which there is an expectation for speaking. Children with selective mutism have the ability to both speak and understand language, but fail to use this ability as a result when we would consider to be social anxiety in adults. Most children with selective mutism function normally in other areas of their lives. Selective mutism is not a communication disorder. It is not part of a developmental disorder either. Selective mutism does not include children with conduct disorders, oppositional, defiant behavior, and/or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Justin would be a very chatty boy at home, but when Justin started kindergarten in 2004, he would not talk at school. He would not talk to his teacher, kids in the classroom, or even kids at his own table at lunch. It was so bad that he had accidents at school because he was too afraid to ask the teacher if he could go to the restroom. I got concerned with it and consulted a child psychologist to see if this was normal behavior, and she explained that this disorder and recommended that she start seeing him on a weekly basis to help him get comfortable talking in places that he may be afraid to speak. We saw her for 2 months, and he started becoming a different child. He eventually got to the point of talking in front of his class of 23 students by the end of the school year. In October of 2004, over 2 years after he failed his first hearing test, Justin received hearing aids and started using them on an everyday basis. He goes to Lake Elmo Elementary School, and the school ordered an FM system for him to use with his hearing aids, which has been a great help. It cuts down on the background noise in the classroom. Now, my second child, Joey, was born on February 5th in 2003 at St. John's Hospital in Maplewood. Newborn hearing screenings were taking place at this time, and this was my very first experience with it. At the hospital, they told us that they perform a newborn hearing screening test before the child is discharged. The day we were getting discharged, Joey was circumcised and also had a hearing screening done shortly after that. The nurse conducting the test informed me that he had failed the test twice. She said that she was going to try one more time, and it could be because he was upset after being circumcised and heavily medicated for pain. She tried it one last time, and he passed. To this day, I still don't know if Joey actually passed or if the nurse just passed him to be done with it. Since we were still taking Justin every 6 months for hearing tests, the ENT and our pediatrician thought it would be beneficial to have Joey tested as well. He had seen lots of cases where this particular hearing loss can be hereditary. Joey had his first hearing test when he was close to a year old. After conducting the test, we were told that Joey had the same hearing loss pattern as his older brother. Joey also had 4 ear infections, and we put tubes in his ears as well and followed the same process we did with Justin. He had tubes done a couple months after Justin. Both boys still have tubes, and their tubes have worked well in the prevention of ear infections. The ENT wants Justin and Joey to be seen every 6 months to keep an eye on their hearing status and their tubes. They do not know at this point if theirs is a progressive hearing loss or not, and because of early hearing detection, we were able to find this. Joey has not showed as much loss as Justin at this point in his life, but the ENT feels it could possibly end up with hearing aids as he does now by the time he goes to school. I have noticed that Joey's speech is a lot better than Justin was when he was his age. I believe this is because we discovered it early enough, and I now know how to help with pronunciations of certain words. I don't think Joey would be talking as much without the help of early detection and my understanding of the hearing situation. St. Paul's Early Childhood Intervention Team has really strived to be on top of each of my children to make sure that there's no gap in their learning. In closing, please take a moment to put yourself in my family's situation. We live in a country that has the greatest knowledge, tools, and technology, and yet Justin and Joey are left with a hearing loss that I believe could have been detected at birth. Our journey would have been much easier if Minnesota supported the early detection of hearing loss. Hospitals need to be required to report failed screenings to the Department of Health to ensure that each baby is followed. Hospitals, screeners, doctors, and ENTs need training and monitoring for proper screening practices. They also need to follow recommendations and protocols so that each baby is screened and reported the same way regardless of where they were born in Minnesota. Please do my family and all new families a favor and add newborn hearing screening to the newborn screening panel. Help every baby with a hearing loss get the timely intervention they deserve. Thank you for your time and attention to this matter that is deeply part of my family.
Thank you, Ms. Mathis. Questions for Ms. Mathis? Seeing none, thank you very much, Senator
Madam Chair, I was told there was somebody from March of Dimes who wanted to speak very briefly.
Okay. We will do the screen. Could that person come to the table, please? Here she comes.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Ann Kewen. I am the State Director of Program Services for the March of Dimes. I'll keep my comments very brief, as I know you have a lot on your agenda today. I just simply wanted to say that we support Senate File 1095. We feel very strongly that this is needed in Minnesota, and we urge you to pass it. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Kewen? Thank you very much. Are there any members of the committee who have questions for Senator Marty? Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Marty, screening, I understand the screening, but did I also understand that it's a report to the Department of Health. Why is that part of it?
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Wergen, this bill and the next bill is an attempt to set up a whole series of support services, and I'd like to turn it over.
As I indicated, we work with states throughout the U.S., and what we find over and over is that screening is only the first and the easiest step of doing this. That just like we do with the blood spot screening, the health department becomes the mechanism to help follow through to make sure that these children get the services that they need. So the health department becomes a safety net as well as the mechanism. And in those states who are not reporting to the State Department, we see high screening rates, but we don't see high rates of identification, and we don't see the kinds of outcomes that you saw on these video clips.
Senator Wergen.
What do you mean you see high screening rates but not high rates of identification? The screening does the identification, doesn't it?
No, the screening only identifies those children who are at risk. And then there's a subsequent test, just like we do with breast cancer screening or prostate cancer screening. They separate the population into two groups, those that need further follow-up and those who are okay. And what we see in states that are doing this effectively with the Department of Health is that better than 90% of those children who fail the screening test get a diagnostic evaluation, and we know whether they can hear or not. In those states that are not reporting it, it's 40 or 50% of parents who will come back. The reason that happens is because many parents interpret signals of their children as that they're hearing normally when they really aren't. And so unless there is a mechanism for that diagnosis to happen, we're not nearly as successful. And this is, as I said, exactly what happens with the blood spot screening already. It's reported to the state, and the state follows up.
Okay. Other questions? If not, Senator Martin. Senator Fischbach.
I called you Mr. President. I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Senator Marty, I'm just wondering about following up a little bit on Senator Wergen's questions. What about the data that the department is collecting? I was just glancing through, and I'm sorry, I I was listening, but I was in the back eating my lunch, so I didn't get a glance at the language in the bill. But I'm wondering about what the issues with the data privacy. I know that might be Judiciary Committee, but I'm just it doesn't seem like there's a lot of language in here about that.
Senator Madam Hardy? Chair, Senator Fischbach, I'm assuming it's treated the same way as all the other data from all the other blood spot tests are, and Senator Berglund may know better than me how that is done.
Madam Chair, Senator and Senator Marty and Senator Fischbach, the Department of Health data is already covered by the privacy laws, and you know the kind of what they do when they have a test that shows that a child might have a disease that is going to make their life very difficult. They call the parents and talk to them not only about the disease but about the things that are available to help that child so that they're not just getting bad news, that they're getting bad news and a helping hand along with it. I based on what the folks told us when we toured the Department of Health labs, they feel that it's very important when you make that call to have information about how you can follow up and the chances for your child's successful development.
Well, and Madam Chair, and Senator Berglund or Senator Martin, in the language here, it says that the hospital shall ensure that the physician or other persons attend. They have to make them aware of the community resources. And so I'm wondering, are we doing both, that the health department will, and then we've required the hospital and or physician or, you know, I'm sure whoever they designate to refer them to early intervention services? I mean, there's some things that are required of the hospital in here that you just mentioned that should be the health department.
May I make a comment, Madam Chair?
Dr. White.
This would be handled exactly the same way that it's handled with the blood spot screening, so that parents who want to opt out of this could opt out of it and say, I don't want my baby screened. However, what we found repeatedly is that the physician who's responsible for the child has so many other things that they need to do that it's the Department of Health that is most effective in keeping track of who needs these services. In the blood spot screening, for example, the doctor is told about it, but the Department of Health also follows up with these families. The family could, of course, say, thank you, but I would prefer not to do anything about it. Although we find in other states that have similar reporting laws that happens in less than 0.5% of all families. So it's a very rare occurrence that would happen.
Madam Chair.
Senator Berglund?
Madam Chair, Senator Fischbach, I certainly am not an expert on this. I'm not the author of this bill, but it would seem to me that there would be a notification going to the hospital and the physician so that it could be in the child's medical record. Then the Department of Health also would be in the loop because they would be able to maybe even know a lot better than the physician or the hospital about resources that might be available in that community. I'm sure some communities, you know, having a child that is born with a hearing loss isn't that frequent, and they may not even know what services are available. But the Department of Health would have their finger on all of that.
Senator Wirken.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I understood from Dr. White that the family can opt out of the hearing assessment. If the family chooses to have the hearing assessment, can they refuse to allow that to be passed on to the Department of Health? I think that's the more contentious part.
Mary Hartnett from the Minnesota Commission Serving Deaf and Hard of Hearing People is here and can comment.
Ms. Hartnett, welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, and Senator, we have complied with the parental consent under Minnesota Statute Section 145.125, so we have cited that, and the parents then would then have to sign off and say that they agreed to have it reported. So they could agree to the screening or refuse the screening, or they could agree to have it reported or not reported, is my understanding with that statute. It references what's in statute currently. And Madam Chair, members of the committee, I also wanted to say that we worked with the Hospital Association, and Senator Fischbach, we worked with the Hospital Association. They actually support this now. So.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Fischbach.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, if you will indulge me. If I could offer an amendment on line or on page 1, lines 5 through 18, the legislative findings and purpose.
Madam Chair, Senator Fischbach, I was expecting the amendment, and I understand we don't normally put this in.
And Madam Chair, Senator Marty, I try not to disappoint you, and so
the audience members, sometimes a bill starts out with what are called legislative findings, and we have some members of the legislature who think that the bill should stand on their own without us trying to tell people what we're trying to do. So Senator Fischbach is moving to delete that language. That's section 1, page 1, line 5 through page 1, line 18. On that motion, any discussion?
Madam Chair, I'm not opposed to the motion, but I do want to point out it is not in, we would not be codifying this in statute either, but I don't have any objection to it.
Okay, on Senator Fischbach's motion. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Adopted. That section is deleted. Any other discussion on the bill? If not, Senator Marty.
The bill will be recommended, passed, and referred to the Committee on Finance.
Okay, Senator Marty moves the Senate File 1095 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to Finance. On that motion, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Aye. Adopted. Thank you, Senator
Madam
Marty.
Chair, we'll
thank
take Senator
Dr.
Sharon's
thank
bill,
you,
which is
Hartnett.
A follow-up to this right away, then, too.
Okay. Thank you. The next bill is Senator Sharon's. Is she here?
If not,
you want me to go
on?
She can't.
Yeah. We should do that.
All right, let's go on to something else then, Senator Marty.
Is Senator Sharon around? Does anybody know? Is she?
Seen her.
If not, we will.
Senator Berglund's got a couple of bills.
Move on to Senator Berglund's bill.
That's the advantage of being.
Oh, Senator Sharon is here, Senator Berglund.
She's locked in.
Senator Berglund, she just came, so we'll have hers first. Welcome to the committee, Senator Sharon. We just had the newborn and infant hearing screening bill, and now we're up for yours.
Thank you. Give me just a moment to pull my all together a bit. It's like having.
I was at a wedding reception on Saturday, and not as bad, but my jacket was tucked in the back of my pants.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Kathy Sharon. I'm happy to be here with the members of this committee to introduce Senate File 384 on behalf of LifeTrack Resources. LifeTrack Resources is a long-standing nonprofit agency located here in St. Paul, and their mission is to build better lives by working together to develop people's strengths. Life Resources provides family-to-family support services to families across Minnesota who have a child who is deaf or hard of hearing. Originally started as a program for families in the metro area, the Parent Guide program was expanded in 2006 to have a parent guide in every region of the state of Minnesota. In the past 5 years, newborn hearing screening began in every hospital in the state. New research is showing that if we find these children and get them into some kind of programming by the age of 6 months, children's language skills are the same as their peers by the age of 5. That's quite impressive. The parent guides provide parents with individual support, access to information, and connection to local parents to help them make crucial decisions in that timely manner. Senate File 384 requests and asks for an appropriation of $100,000 per year to maintain the parent-to-parent network in Greater Minnesota. And to provide further details about the program, I'd like to introduce Candace Lindau Davies, a parent of a child who is deaf, and the Family Support Connection Coordinator of LifeTrack Resources.
Thank you, Senator Sharon, and thank you
Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Candace Lindo-Davies. I am very pleased to be here before you to discuss the opportunity or to have the opportunity to continue a dialogue about how we can create a complete system of support for all Minnesota families with children who are deaf and hard of hearing. I am the proud mother of an 11-year-old son who is profoundly deaf. I'm among 95% of parents with children who are deaf and hard of hearing, a hearing parent who had no experience or prior knowledge about hearing-related issues. I'm also privileged to be the coordinator of the Family Support Connection at LifeTrack Resources, a parent network for Minnesota families with children who are deaf and hard of hearing. Today, I do ask for your support for a $100,000 annual partnership with the Minnesota Department of Health. The Family Support Connection was started at LifeTrack Resources in 2000, primarily as a metro service through private funding provided by the Greater Twin Cities United Way. For the past 5 years, the Minnesota Department of Health, charged with the task of implementing newborn hearing screening and early intervention systems, has contracted with LifeTrack Resources to provide a parent-to-parent support network throughout the state. In the testimony you've just heard by Dr. Carl White, advancements in the identification of hearing loss and hearing technology have dramatically changed potential outcomes for our youth. This is tremendous news for parents like myself who have children born too long ago to benefit. But as you've just heard, screening our children is not enough. A complete support system needs to be established. With your help, we can legislate that all children are screened at birth. We can legislate that all children identified are reported to the Department of Health. We can also legislate that families receive quality and appropriate intervention services for their child. What we cannot legislate is a parent's reaction to the news that their child has a permanent hearing loss that could dramatically impair their language, social, and cognitive development. And we cannot legislate that parents will be able to move beyond their feelings of grief, isolation, especially in Greater Minnesota, and a feeling of inadequacy to advocate and make critical decisions for their child almost immediately. However, we can legislate financial support for trained parent guides to move parents beyond that grief. The Family Support Connections parent guides provide parents with emotional support from the perspective of someone who has lived that experience firsthand. They can provide unbiased information about all communication, educational, and medical options, which they are often overwhelmed with conflicting professional advice. They can link families to one another, give them access to experts in the field, provide them with news about emerging issues and research, as well as offer a parent newsletter, lending library, and educational workshops. All the support means parents are better equipped to make decisions for their child even earlier. Last year alone, we responded to direct requests for services from 492 unduplicated parents and professionals with recurring funding for just over one full-time equivalent. The need has been demonstrated, and the program has been successful. In 2006, the Family Support Connection expanded to include trained parent guides in every region of Minnesota and became the Minnesota chapter of a growing national organization, Hands and Voices. However, Department of Health funding will end in 2008 and currently does not fully cover the cost of the Metro nor the Greater Minnesota Parent Guide Program. While corporate and foundation grants have helped support this project, consistency and continuation of the program requires a public investment. In particular, funding for families in Greater Minnesota is at risk. These families deserve the same access to services as families in the metro communities. The cost savings of identifying and successfully intervening with even one child, as Dr. Carl White pointed out, would cover the full cost of the Family Support Connection for 1 year. We ask for your small investment in the future of our children who are deaf and hard of hearing, to consider a full and necessary package of support for all Minnesota families, and to invite you to listen to one parent's story. I would like to introduce next Kristen Hemstock will speak.
Can I ask you to be extremely brief, because we've been told this bill may have been transferred from on the floor to the budget division, which is where they're going to spend most time anyway. So we will take action on it in case it is in front of us, but if you could just give like 1 minute or two, because the decision is going to be made in the finance division, and I'm sorry about the confusion about where the bill is. But.
Thank you. Hello, my name is Kristen Hemstock, and I am the parent of an 8-year-old son with hearing loss. Despite failing numerous newborn hearing screenings at birth, my son Carter was not diagnosed with his hearing loss until age 5 1/2. Unfortunately, we were one of the families who fell through the cracks. As hearing parents, we didn't know where to turn for information about hearing loss. We had critical decisions to make, and we were 5.5 years behind. The school and our audiologist presented communication and educational options available to us, but something was missing. What really would have helped us to navigate those first few months better was another parent. Another parent who had been there before us. Someone to share their experience with us, to let us know what worked for them and how to go about achieving it. To encourage us and to help connect us as only a parent can, parent to parent. Over time, we were able to connect with a couple of other families, and what a blessing it was to talk with someone who knew just how we felt and who felt the same urgency about how important this was for our children's future. Parents who had the same life aspirations for their child with hearing loss. The effect on Carter was equally as powerful. Meeting other children with hearing loss, just seeing their hearing aids, getting to know them and see how resilient they were, seeing all that they had accomplished, served as such a good role model for him. Now my son is the role model, sharing with the younger children the idea that they can do anything they set their minds to if they have the proper support. For us, that came in the form of family-to-family support. Because of this, I became the parent guide for Southwest Minnesota. I work with families who are trying to navigate this overwhelming time. I offer support, encouragement, connections to other families, and connections to local resources. Most of these families know no other families who share their experience. Many live in rural areas and feel very isolated. Having a statewide parent network and a trained parent who knows the resources of each community is so very necessary. Professionals can deliver necessary information. Parent guides can motivate other parents to take action and to be living proof that they can and will have successful children. I urge you to support the appropriation of funds for the Family Support Connection, Minnesota Hands and Voices. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee. Again, as I mentioned, this is basically going to be dealt with as a budget issue, and I know this is one of the bills that meets the whole package of services that the commission was recommending. Because of that, Senator Dowell, be willing to move the...
Yes, I move the...
Senate File 384.
Senate File 384. Be passed.
Be recommended passed and referred to the Committee on Finance, where the decision would be made then. Is there any discussion of that motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. 1-0.
Thank you very much.
Senator Berglund, do you want to take one of yours up? We're going to take Senator Cohen's bill up next, but he's not here yet, so if you can do whichever one of yours you want first. Which one would you like to begin with?
Well, why don't we take Senate File 357.
Senate File 357. And you have an A1 amendment, I believe?
Yes, I do.
Senator Berglund moves the A1 amendment to Senate File 357 to put the bill in the shape she wants it. Is there any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, this I have this bill before the committee today because I've become aware since... all of the budget difficulties that various units of government have been in over the years, or over the past few years, that some of our local units of government have created policies whereby when there is funding that is provided by the State Housing Finance Agency to an organization to build some housing, to make housing affordable and make it more available to low-income families, that some of these local units of government are now charging fees to the nonprofit developers who are developing this housing, so that it's almost like they're taking money off of the top of what the grant is that they're getting from the State Housing Finance Agency. And of course, that makes the housing less affordable, and it makes the scarce resources we have at the state level to make affordable housing available less available. And so what this bill is saying is that when an organization is receiving funding from the State Housing Finance Agency for a housing project, that the city or other agencies that are transferring land to that organization would not be charging them a fee greater than whatever the cost of the acquisition of the property was to the local unit of government in the first place. And so it's not trying to say that they can't charge them a fee, but they can't charge them more than what their actual costs were. And so that's really the intent of the bill, and I'd like to have Chad Schwitter, the executive director of Urban Homeworks, come to the table to talk about.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Schwitter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Chad Schwitter. I live in North Minneapolis. I've got three little cherubs that are under 4 years old, and I work for a nonprofit faith-based organization called Urban Homeworks. And I think at the core of these discussions is creating community and being able to get housing affordable to folks in our communities. And at the core of the issue for us as a nonprofit housing developer is acquisition costs. And we are being asked right now to respond to RFPs by the city and sometimes the county or show up at public auction at the county in order to acquire property that is in their property portfolios. And then once we acquire the property, to turn back around and respond to more RFPs for funding in order to provide for affordability and value gap financing to provide housing to households at 30, 40, 50, sometimes 80% of metro median income. And so I'm here to testify in favor of this bill as a way to eliminate one of the barriers to entry for nonprofit organizations to provide affordable housing for our community.
Thank you very much. Did you have anybody else?
Is Matt Schulek here?
Sochak.
Thank you.
Mr. Sochak, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Matt Sochak. I am a project manager with Project for Pride and Living, otherwise known as PPL. We're a nonprofit housing developer that is based in Minneapolis. If you haven't heard of us, we've developed over 400 units of ownership housing since 1972, many of those units on lots that were previously tax forfeited in the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. So Senate File 357 is certainly one that would affect us. I'd like to say that PPL supports Senate File 357, and I'd like to thank Senator Berglund for putting it forth. Charging affordable housing developers such as PPL a market price for publicly controlled land in a project that is otherwise publicly subsidized has the effect of simply taking money out of one public pocket and putting it in another. Just to provide an example, it costs PPL approximately $180,000 to build a quality, affordable home, a single-family detached home that conforms to most urban neighborhoods. If we sell that home for approximately the cost, and we have a buyer at 60% of the area median income who has a $5,000 down payment, they mortgage approximately $175,000. And their PITI is approximately $1,400 per month. This would represent 34% of their monthly income and would barely be affordable simply at cost. Now, if you add in a land acquisition cost of approximately $30,000, hey, you have a mortgage of $210,000, a payment of $1,650 per month, and a percent of payment income to payment ratio of 42%. The home is no longer affordable at that point. So this is really the land acquisition cost can be the difference between being affordable and not being affordable. To make homes affordable in these situations, we often request affordability gap dollars from the state, from the city, from the county. And what these dollars do is effectively buy the amount of the mortgage that the buyer would otherwise have to obtain down to get it to an affordable level. But in reality, what this does is really takes the dollars from one pocket and puts it into another to subsidize the cost of the land. If there is no affordable subsidy in these situations, the project may not be feasible. An affordable housing opportunity is not created. Senate files 357 could allow nonprofits such as ours to build many more homes each year. And again, I ask for your support. I'd like to thank Senator Berglund for putting the proposal forth. We've appreciated the partnership we've had with the state that has allowed us to produce so many affordable housing opportunities here in the Twin Cities Metro. We ask that you help us to continue to help you and to help us create be in a position to create affordable homeownership opportunities well into the future. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Suchet. Is there any questions from the committee? Is there anybody? Okay, Senator Patricia Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Berglund, I am curious about the cost to the city. But is there a cost to the city when we said that the property should be transferred to the organization at the cost of acquisition for the city and also to waive all development and other fees related to the project?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Torres-Ray, obviously if the city is charging these folks money now and the bill passes, they wouldn't be able to charge them more than their actual costs. But I didn't think that we created the State Housing Finance Agency to be a miniature local government aid program. We created it and we fund it, and when we vote for those appropriations on the floor of the Senate, we're voting for them because we believe we're providing more affordable housing opportunities for people in the state of Minnesota. I think if the local units of government need local government aid, they should be getting local government aid through local government aid formulas, not through appropriations that are made to state agencies for the purpose of providing affordable housing.
I understand. I think your point is legitimate. I will ask if anyone from cities or counties or anyone else wanted to testify with concerns about the bill. Seeing no one, is there any further discussion? If not, Senator Berglund moves Senate File 357 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the floor. I guess we haven't heard any requests. On that motion, any discussion? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Berglund, you might as well stay for the other one. Senator Cohen couldn't come down quite yet.
Okay. Next, then, why don't we take the 196.
Senate File 196. And do you have an A1 amendment for that as well, I believe? At least I see one in the packets. Is that correct?
Yes, I'm not sure if I have it, though.
We'll make sure you
Someone
get one.
Can bring me.
It's an A1 amendment. It is an author's amendment, though. It's coming.
Thank you very much.
Is that the right one?
This is a technical amendment, Mr.
Senator
Chairman.
Senator Berglund moves the A1 amendment. Is there any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, this is a bill that I've worked on for a few years now. It comes out of the knowledge that we really have a lot of elders that are going to be in the pipeline in the future. We have the baby boomers becoming elders, and the baby boomers becoming elders means that we are going to have many, many more elderly in our population than there are working people in our population. And that means that we have to worry about, as a state, how those elderly folks are going to be able to afford both their housing and their health care costs in the future. There have been studies done. There was a study done by the University of Minnesota looking at that very question for the future of Minnesota, suggesting that our costs of providing long-term care in the future will grow by 25%. And it's going to be very difficult for us to meet that kind of a increased demand for funding. So we keep looking for ways to try to help people be able to manage creatively to infuse more of their own private dollars into meeting their long-term health care needs. Last session, I was very happy that we finally passed the long-term care partnership bill, which will allow partnership insurance policies to be sold in the state of Minnesota, which will bridge long-term care insurance and the Medicaid program. This bill is another bill to help people at a different point in the long-term care continuum. This is a bill that will provide an incentive for people who live in low-valued homes to be able to take a reverse mortgage on their home. And if they use up the money that's available to them from their reverse mortgage, they will then be eligible for the alternative care grant program without regard to income or assets. So it's like a partnership program with the insurance program. It's a similar concept, only using reverse mortgage for people that have low-valued homes. These homes primarily exist in rural Minnesota, most everybody in the metro area. Even in my district, probably would not benefit from a bill like this. But when you have become older and you're at a point in the continuum of the age spectrum where long-term care insurance is not practical for you any longer, a reverse mortgage may be. And so this is a bill that would really encourage people to take out reverse mortgages and reward them when they do that and spend it on their long-term care needs. We know sometimes people take out reverse mortgages when they're older to go on vacations and things like that. That's not what this bill's for. This bill is to help people meet their long-term care needs. And so we believe that there are people, if this was made available, who would take advantage of using the equity in their home then to be able to meet their long-term care needs. Why do we need to do this for people in low-valued homes? Because when you take out a reverse mortgage, there are certain fixed costs. Because a reverse mortgage, which they're all guaranteed by the federal government, require that a person be able to live in their home as long as they want to. As long as they want to reside in that home, even if they've used up their equity, the reverse mortgage will not be collected against the value of their home. And so the closing costs and the other things associated with these kind of loans are fairly large. Well, if you have a small amount of equity in your home to start with, say you have only maybe a $50,000 or a $75,000 home, you're going to see easily, you know, 30-40% of your equity used up in the closing costs of the loan. So it's quite a bit of sticker shock for someone that has a lower valued home. We hope through this bill to help educate people through the senior linkage line about the practical application of reverse mortgages for meeting your long-term care needs. And we hope to educate people in lower valued homes specifically about how the state is willing to partner with them so that they would then have more access to the alternative care grant program than they otherwise might have had. And so with that, Mr. Chairman, I would like to call on Bonnie Clark. She is a reverse mortgage counselor in the state of Minnesota.
And Senator Berglund, I understand you also have somebody from Board on Aging and DHS for answering questions.
This is not a governor's initiative, unfortunately. I thought maybe after we had it around for a year or so. It doesn't cost very much, this bill. We thought they might include it, but they haven't. So obviously the department cannot be here to testify in support of the bill, but they did provide quite a bit of technical assistance in the work group that we had that worked on this a little over a year ago to put this bill together.
If there are questions, they're available for her. Okay, Ms. Clark, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. you like me just to go ahead and talk now?
Yeah. Okay. Well, good afternoon, Chairman Marty, Senator Berglund, and members of the committee. My name is Bonnie Clark, and I represent Reverse Mortgage Counselors, Incorporated. We are a nonprofit, HUD-approved reverse mortgage counseling agency. And I have done reverse mortgage counseling since 1992. And in the 90s, we did a couple sessions a week. That was a big deal. But around 2001, there was an increased demand for counseling, and we started doing probably about two sessions a day. In the last couple years, I have done about 400-plus counseling sessions. Some of the people I counsel are just curious. They're interested. They do not go through with a reverse mortgage. But about two-thirds of the people I counsel proceed with a reverse mortgage. The people we counsel are varied, but typically their income is lower. Their house is their most valuable asset, and they would like to remain living in their home. For most of them, even if they sold the house and moved, it would be a struggle for them to afford a market-rate apartment on their income. I just did a HUD report because we do report to HUD, and the last few months I counseled 80 people. This would be October 2006 through December 2006. And 64 out of 80 were less made less than 50% of the area median income. 11 were 50 to 79% of the area median income. 2 were 80 to 100%, and 3 chose not to respond. I counsel people in my office. I go to their homes sometimes if they're disabled or cannot drive. I also do phone counseling. And I have gone to nursing homes and counseled people and their families. And if someone's in a nursing home, I particularly want the family there. We help with help from the family and using home health care, some people are able to return home. And I think in the last couple years, I have done 5 of those, and they were able to return to their home. People seek a reverse mortgage for a variety of reasons, and there was a study is a couple years old, but it was done by HUD and AARP jointly. And in their study, they found that the first reason people use a reverse mortgage was to use it to cover hospital, health care costs, and to pay for prescription drugs. The second reason was it to pay for an existing mortgage. And many times they have taken out a home equity loan before they talk to us, which is very difficult because then they are not able to pay back that home equity loan, and then they seek a reverse mortgage. Tied for third place, reduce burden on their children and home improvement, the next to pay property taxes, and the last just to pay daily expenses to have enough money to live on. During a typical counseling session, I go over the figures step by step, sometimes more than once. I recommend or we talk about alternatives to a reverse mortgage, moving, selling, discussing what is available for housing. We discuss resources that can help them as they age, such as the senior linkage line and other helplines. We discuss programs that can help them stay in their homes, such as store-to-door groceries, telephone assistance, energy assistance, home improvement programs, accessibility loan programs. And I have an example, just one example, and this one is here in the city. This is the person, I'll call her Mrs. Olson, not her real name. And she was almost 90 years old, had never married. She had lived at home and taken care of her parents until they passed away. She inherited their rather modest house, but the house was worth a great deal because it was over by the lakes, the Minneapolis area. She had been doing just fine even at 90 years old and was totally independent, and she had an accident. Due to the accident, she had incurred a great deal of medical expenses and costs and depleted her savings and her investments. In other words, she had no money left except for the equity in her house. She could stay in her home, and with some assistance and a friendly neighbor and home health care, she would do just fine. She was close to 90, so she could access a great deal of money from her home. The older you are, the more money you can get out of your home because basically they expect you to live to 100. So if you're 90 years old, they don't expect you to live as long so that you can access more equity. She told me that she had lived in her home, taken care of her parents until they died, and that was her expectation. She just wanted to live in her home until she died. She did not want to be in a nursing home. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Clark. And you believe that the incentives here will be very helpful in encouraging people.
I do think so, because I do counsel people outside the metro area. And, you know, the first time I did that, I was just amazed, you know, that someone had a house for $100,000. And I am from a rural area originally, and, you know, once you live in the city for a period of time, you know, a $200,000 house is modest here. And you forget what houses cost in rural areas, but they are, their value is much less. But also other things are much less there, too.
The questions from the committee. Is there anybody else in the audience who wanted to speak to the bill? Not. Senator Berglund moves.
I move that Senate File 196 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance.
On that motion, any discussion? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. And I'm not sure that Senator Cohen is here yet, but I think what we should do, just because that's a major bill and there are a number of people who have come for that, that maybe what we could do is
he's there now,
begin with the witnesses on it. There it is. Senator Cohen just came in right then. Go ahead. We just called for you. Senate File 442, Housing Solutions Act. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, thank you. This is legislation. I'm trying to glance around the committee to see who possibly has not heard this before. I know I notice you do have some new members. This is the legislation that has been worked on for the last couple of years to do something about what I would suggest is almost bordering on the criminal in terms of providing housing in the state at a variety of levels, whether it be for the homeless population, whether it be for the population that doesn't have the ability to afford housing, whether it be for every area of the state, we have fallen significantly behind where we ought to be. And, Mr. Chairman, let me just indicate a little bit about the history. In particular, I want to make reference to our 2001 session. And again, trying to glance around the membership as to whom was here 6 years ago. But I think everybody at the table was aware of what the situation was in 2001. In 2001, we had a significant surplus. Now, putting aside how we handled things that year or did not handle things, we all remember that in the legislature, with the surplus monies, we did a variety of things in our appropriation and finance bills. We had a significant amount, as we do this year, we had a significant amount of one-time money that was not usable in subsequent bienniums. At that time, Mr. Chairman, the finance jurisdiction for housing programs was within the State Department's division, which I then chaired. And again, for new members, we've changed the jurisdictions of these finance divisions several times. The State Department's division at that time was a fairly large division that now is comprised. Now it's basically, I think, 2.5 divisions. I had appropriated at that time a significant amount of one-time money for housing, and the money was in the variety of housing programs within the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. What happened to that money by the end of the session is, because of the position of then-Governor Ventura and the House of Representatives, that one-time money turned into rebates. And obviously, Mr. Chairman, as you recall, we had more money into a rebate bill or proposal than the total amount I had for housing. But that was certainly a significant part of what happened to the housing appropriation. We have not been able to provide since that time more than a small amount by way of housing. To give Governor Pawlenty his due, Governor Pawlenty has certainly provided some money for housing. And certainly in this year's budget, his proposal is, I think, a good one. It doesn't come anywhere near toward meeting the needs, but it's a decent one. Certainly in the bonding bill last year, he provided some support. So I don't fault the administration or Governor Pawlenty for making every effort. And certainly Mr. Marks, as head of the agency, and the people within the agency have done an excellent job of working with the resources they have available. But the reality, Mr. Chairman, is that the problem continues to grow and grow and grow. We have a population now that's approximately 5 million people. We have populations that cannot get affordable housing. And, Mr. Chairman, I'll suggest that the connection of joblessness to the inability to secure housing, to a person's socioeconomic status, to the ability to have health care insurance, those are not problems that are separate and distinct from each other. They're all interrelated. And I guess I should have also added transportation, the ability to get from an affordable housing situation to a job. So these are problems that are all connected. And obviously this year we are talking about trying to pass a major transportation bill that would provide people a way to get from one place to another, whether it be through roads or through transit. We are talking about providing health insurance of some sort by expansion of either present programs or some new programs, as demonstrated through Senate File 2. And this is the other part of what we need to do, is to provide housing. Now, the problem, of course, we have is that we know resources are limited. I attempted to use surplus monies when there was a significant amount in 2001. That didn't work for the reasons I mentioned. This is an attempt to secure monies through a modest use of the deed tax. Now, I also know members, and maybe I'll address this in particular, Mr. Chairman, if you'll allow me to, Senator Dahl and Senator Lynch, as new members of the committee and the Senate, that you know this is an example of where we all get a significant amount of mail from constituents, and we'll hear some people talk in opposition to this legislation. But I think this is a reasonable way to try to take care of what is a problem that's not going to go away. And I'm sorry, Senator Ray, I was talking about new members of the committee. I was kind of looking at the wings. Sorry. I apologize. And this is I think, a reasonable solution to what is an ever-growing problem. So, Mr. Chairman, that's my rhetoric in beginning this discussion. Let me ask Mr. Dahl to talk about the process that led to this bill, and I was certainly involved, but not on a daily basis, in the promulgation of this proposal. We have many advocates here, as you know, Mr. Chairman. Let me have Mr. Dahl address some of the particulars as well as the process. And, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure who you have on your agenda in terms of length of the agenda to testify, numbers of people. But let me ask Mr. Dahl to go ahead.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Fishbach.
Mr. Chair, and maybe Senator Cohen. Mr. Dahl, is someone going to explain the bill, like actually go through so that
yes.
we have? Because I haven't, even though I was here for several years, I haven't seen this, haven't had it in front of a committee
no,
before.
No, Mr. Chairman.
So I'd be interested in going through the bill.
Mr. Chairman, I didn't mean to leave Senator Fishbach out.
Well, so no, I'm just saying, I mean, I didn't want to, Mr. Chair,
no,
I'm
ask
sorry.
Mr.
I just, I haven't been explaining the bill before, so I wanted to explain.
And Mr. Chairman, and the reason I was doing some of the rhetoric and we could turn over to Mr. Dahl is I can go through the bill in detail as well. Unfortunately, Mr. Chairman, we're in the process of, to be blunt, setting all the targets, and I'm going to spend a little bit of time on the phone if that's okay, Mr. Chairman. So, but I'll be here.
Mr. Dahl can explain the bill.
Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Senator Torres-Ray.
If I may, I just would like to get a request that people who come to testify also disclose where do they work, because I have received 800 emails about this issue, and most of the people who have sent emails to my office work for realty companies, so they are realtors. So I would like to know who is here to testify on behalf or against this bill, because okay. most of the people work for companies that I would like to know that.
We'll ask witnesses if they're willing to tell us where they work. Mr. Dahl, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, my name is Michael. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Dahl. I'm the executive director with the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. And if I could actually ask the folks who are going to be testifying in support of the bill to come up to the table. Some of them are realtors, too, and they'll identify themselves as such. Again, I'm Michael Dahl with the Coalition for the Homeless, and I want to give a little bit of information about the need for this legislation, what it accomplishes, and then our hopes for this to continue to move along the process so that we can get serious funding for affordable housing programs that have seen dramatic cuts in the past several years. One out of every eight Minnesota households will pay over 50% of their income for housing. Tonight, there'll be 10,000 people who experience homelessness and 20,000 that are either homeless or precariously housed, which is known to some people as couch hopping or staying with someone tonight but not knowing where they'll stay tomorrow. We must stop the fact that people are jumping, are living paycheck to paycheck to afford their housing, and the fact that people are living on our streets. These terrible numbers, these terrible situations require bold action, and the Housing Solutions Act was an effort to get at that bold action. The Housing Solutions Act would help us get thousands of more rental assistance vouchers to extremely low-income households. It would help us develop more workforce housing, especially when there are employers who are in dire need of more housing so that they can develop into new communities. And it would also channel funds into a local leverage fund so that when city governments, county governments want to donate land or resources or finances to help develop housing in their community, we can send state matching dollars to them as well. I wish I could say that this is a solution, a full solution to the housing and homelessness problem in our state, but it's not. You all received a graph that points out funding for the Housing Finance Agency since 1996-1997. And in 2000-2001, we had $171 million that were going to our Housing Finance Agency. Some of this was one-time money, some of it was base. We were able to use it all. We weren't anywhere near meeting capacity. Right now, we have $70 million in our Housing Finance Agency, $100 million cut from its budget. That doesn't even include for inflation. If you compare 2002-2003 data, where we had $108 million in our Housing Finance Agency, compare that to what it would be worth today, we would need $124 to $144 million to simply be keeping pace with that year's spending. The Housing Solutions Act allows us to accomplish that and go a little bit further. And our hope is that we can see this as a first step towards addressing our housing crisis in the state. Here is what the Housing Solutions Act would do. First, we have a high priority for getting funds to pay for rental vouchers for extremely low-income people. Currently, the Housing Finance Agency uses the Housing Trust Fund to accomplish this. And the average recipient has a household income of $7,747 a year, an extremely low income that we can successfully house when we provide rental vouchers. The amount of funds that this would generate would help us assist 6,500 households into housing opportunities that currently are in housing they cannot afford. The Challenge Fund, which helps us develop workforce housing, would help 1,400 households into new rental housing and would also help 1,200 households become homeowners. All told, the Housing Solutions Act would help us assist 9,000 households who are in housing they cannot afford or are homeless into housing that they can be stable in. I pointed out at the first part of my testimony that one in eight Minnesota households are living in housing they cannot afford. They're paying 50% of their income for that housing. That equates to over 220,000 households in the state paying over half of their income for their housing. This bill would help us get to 9,000 of those households. This is not the end-all be-all, but it helps us make a great step in the right direction. And so that we ask that you please take the step appropriating these funds to these two very proven programs and one that we hope will leverage new dollars from local units of government who want to do right by people who are trying to live in their community. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dahl. You want to go through the bill section by section? Or it's fairly clear in terms of what it's doing, but certainly it would help if we could hear the amount of
sure.
the tax rates and the where the programs are, which how much is going to each one.
Sure. Mr. Chair, the Housing Solutions Act raises money through a small increase in the deed tax, which is a tax, a state tax that is collected by the counties. Currently, our deed tax is 0.33%. It would raise it to 0.5%. That additional 0.17 would be used to channel new funds into affordable housing. Of the new funds generated, 42% of the funds would go for rental assistance to extremely low-income households. 33% would go to the Challenge Fund, which is the Workforce Development Housing account inside the Housing Finance Agency. And 25% of the funds would go to the local incentive fund, HALO, which is a matching program for city and county governments that want to contribute resources to affordable housing development in their community. I can get into more details on percentage breakdown for greater Minnesota versus the metro area. Details like that, I just don't know how specific you'd like me to be.
We can go by questions on that. How much does it is the total amount that is in here? Did you say that earlier? I think I heard.
The amount that the Housing Solutions Act would raise varies depending on the housing market. Right now, according to the forecast, I believe we would raise slightly over $100 million for affordable housing. Two or three forecasts ago, when the housing market was in a stronger position, we would have raised $160 million over the biennium. And we actually chose the deed tax quite intentionally. It follows the housing market. So when housing costs more and it's harder for low-income people to get into housing, rental, or home ownership, we raise more so that we can have more assistance to provide. When the housing market isn't doing as well, we raise less, but then it is also less difficult for low-income folks to get into the housing that is available in their community.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Dahl, can you tell me approximately how much that would be per, I mean, if you, $200,000 house, mm-hmm. what would that increase be?
Mr. Chair, Senator Fischbach, the deed tax increase would be 0.17%, so that's $170 per $100,000 in value. For a $200,000 home, that would work out to $340 on the home sale. And the fee is paid by the home seller.
Further questions? If not, if you want to call on your next witness.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Monica Williams. I've been a real estate professional for 35 years, the last 16 years working for Coldwell Banker as a real estate agent. I'm also a homeowner for 30 years. And I was here last year, and I'm here again to speak on behalf of the Housing Solutions Act. Proposed last year in response to declining state funding for Minnesota's urgent affordable housing needs, the Housing Solutions Act was advanced. It's a small surcharge, 0.017%, on deed transfers, which go strictly for our low-income housing needs administered by the Minnesota Housing Agency. And here we are again in the year 2007. But the need for rental assistance, workforce housing, and local incentive funds to meet community housing needs around the state did not go away. In fact, as Mike pointed out, there are many households in Minnesota right now that are paying more than 30% a month for out of their income for housing. They can't afford what they're living in. A small dedicated surcharge revenue stream for affordable housing can create new construction and home ownership programs that generate new revenue streams and markets for builders and realtors. Every $10 million invested in the state housing industry provides $69 million in new wages and over 2,000 new jobs. The Twin Cities region loses $265 million in consumer spending/business income annually because of a lack of workforce housing. At least 10 other states in the country use this method or something similar with the support of realtors and business community. They understand the investment. Deed transfer revenue is considered to be among the least regressive revenue sources for available housing needs because the amount paid increases proportionally as the property values increase. People closely associated with the housing issues in the communities know that stable housing leads to healthier children, better test scores, less violence, benefits to the state, economy, and our future, possibly offsetting the surcharge amount requested. The small surcharge request is an investment in our most precious capital, people. Investing in housing stability creates a better workforce, and they're contributors to the state economy. The values of our medium housing stock has risen 50% from 2000 to 2005, and now we're seeing a more modest increase. This small surcharge of 0.017% will not hurt home sales. And just for clarification, the foreclosures in the news are excepted from the deed transfer revenue or tax. It's time to reinvest in our future. And I also have a letter here from another realtor from Edina Realty, Connie Coleman, and I'd like to be sure that these letters get around to you as well in support of the Housing Solutions Act. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Williams. Go ahead, sir.
Hi. My name is Hal Clapp. I am a realtor. I'm also a housing consultant, and I'm not one of the 800 that emailed you, but I'll be sure you get one shortly. I'm here, actually, in support of this act, this Housing Solutions Act, and I come from a sort of an enlightened self-interest approach, which I'm sure you're used to over the years. But as I started to look at this and really sort of analyze where the market is heading, one of my specialties is emerging markets. We know by our own trade group that the bulk of the buyers in the future are going to be from emerging markets, over 40%. I wanted to take a moment to sort of dispel some of the, I guess, misinformation that comes across realtors like ourselves every day, biweekly. We get an email from the association or from some real estate blog telling us to send an email to our legislators and try to kill this bill. Some of the things that are said are the deed tax would cost the typical homeowner upwards of $1,000 just to transfer the property. Now, this is in big, bold letters, exclamation points. Well, if you look at the bill, it states that $743 that was existing. The actual increase is $383. So it's not a $1,000 increase. It's a $383 increase. And then it follows that up with look for 1,000 to 2,000 price increase in home prices next year. Well, again, the increase would be $383, not $2,000. And I guess as an aside, if you're going to look at where you capture $350 out of the real estate transaction, it might be worthwhile looking at some of the junk fees that are on the closing statement, because myself as a realtor and someone that's passionate about emerging markets buyers and first-time homeowners, I would be more than proud to tell any one of my customers who's selling a $500,000 house that the $600 that they're paying at the closing table is going to go to help somebody get where they are today. So that's a fee that you can explain. What you can't explain is dock preparation fee, $300, and all these other add-on fees. So the other thing you'll hear is that Minnesota has one of the highest homeownership rates in the country. Well, that's true. We do. However, we're also eighth in terms of gap between homeownership rates of people of color in the white population. So we have a huge gap to make up, and that's part of what this bill will do. Might also say that one of the reasons that we have such a high homeownership rate is because people like myself 20 years ago took advantage of programs like this to get into my first home, and thank you very much. I now have a wife and two children, and I live in St. Paul, and I've renovated the house. I've added on. I've used rehab programs through the city. I've used funds through the state to build my equity in my house and raise my family. Then they'll say, finally, that these are targeted to people at 115% of median income. That's $85,000. Well, no. If they read the bill, they would see that the challenge fund, the average income is $21,000. The housing trust fund, as Michael pointed out, is $7,000. And where they get the 115% is in the HALO, which is targeting renters below 60% of median income, and they say up to 115% for homeowners. But I'll tell you why that is. That is because when we try to do mixed-income projects, as part of one of my jobs around the state, we try to do mixed-income projects, and that requires that people that live there are, you know, stretch above 80% so we don't have pockets of low-income housing. I have worked on a number of projects around the state. In Brainerd, hundreds of families have been helped into homeownership. We have a project that's on the books now that will convert the high school to artist lofts. In Winona and Fillmore counties, we have a dozen families moved into the Jimmy Carter Place, where first-time home buyers, Habitat for Humanity Partnership, as well in those counties. And in Winona, they have a rehab program where homeowners are being afforded monies to fix up their houses, make them energy efficient, and save them more money out of their pocket. In Painesville, Tri-County Community Action does scattered site housing in market rate developments for first-time home buyers that now have an opportunity to live in a new home. Rochester, thousands and thousands of people have gotten out of rentership and into homeownership and opened up those rental units in a really tight housing market to families that needed them. And then finally, I guess, you know, presented with this body of information, you wonder why there aren't more realtors behind me supporting this. But you can see that these kinds of sort of statements would cause one to simply click the button and say, I want to respond to my legislator. And that's why you're getting 800 emails. I think economists call this the elasticity of demand. I'm not an economist, but I thought that sounded nice. What it means is basically that this amount of increase is not enough to affect a buyer or a seller from selling their house. Because one of the things you'll also hear is that the housing market will collapse if this bill passes. Well, that's absolutely not true. There is no homeowner or no seller that for the cost of $350 is going to decide, I don't want to buy a house or I don't want to sell my house. So, but the aggregate effect of all of this is, as others have pointed out before me, a huge boon and a huge influx of money into a much-needed area to boost rental, homeownership, and homeless housing. I'll finish by saying one of my prior employers, the Greater Twin Cities United Way, where I was the housing director, launched a program called Housing Connections Initiative. It was launched explicitly because then CEO Jim Colville went out to a number of the 260 social service agencies and asked, what's your main concern? Housing. Housing was the main concern and still is today, I'll tell you. Time and time again, social service providers said, but for the lack of affordable housing, we can't provide the services that you pay us to do, we can't provide because families are moving, families are in crisis, they don't have the money to, they're tending to their housing needs versus others. Finally, we have, so United Way said there's a direct correlation between educational success, employment, and health, and it has everything to do with housing. But what I heard when I went out and fundraised for the program was, we'll do what we can, but isn't this a state problem? Isn't this something that the government should be doing and not business and not individual donors? And I think that's partly true. Yes, if government puts a good foot forward, I've worked with a number of employer-assisted housing programs, they're willing to put money in, but they see the problem as huge and too overwhelming for them. So I think this is a great start, and I think you'll find that it will leverage hundreds of millions of dollars in additional funds. And finally, we have a governor's plan to end homelessness, and we have an emerging markets homeownership initiative, and neither of those are going anywhere without some funding like this to help push the ball uphill. So thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Clapp. And I want to ask the witnesses to try and be brief because we have one more in support and two listed as opposition to it.
We want to make sure we get this bill done, and we have to be out of here by 3, and I'd like to get the other bills yet. So please go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'll be brief. I'm not a realtor. I'm a retired business executive, and I didn't send emails, but we have gotten 2,400 signatures, which I've gotten quite a few of, in support of the bill. In my working day, I had responsibility for an organization of about 500 people at all different income levels.
Could you and state your name and business for the tape?
I'm sorry, could Bill Keats?
And your name and business for the tape.
My name is Bill Keats, and I'm a retired business executive. Had responsibility for about 500 people at all different income levels. And I saw firsthand the impact, particularly at lower income levels, the ability to have a stable home was on productivity at the workforce. That's caused me to spend a good bit of my my retirement volunteer effort advocating for affordable housing. The other reason that I think specifically the Housing Solution Act makes good business sense is kind of a summary of the comments you've heard. What it's going after is revenue from the housing market. Any real estate transaction where typically appreciation has occurred and not been taxed, we're asking for some of that appreciation back to allow thousands of people that will now come into the business of owning a home and or being able to afford rent and in that way add to the business community, and certainly their own productivity will be significantly impacted. So I thank you for the time.
Thank you, Mr. Keats. Questions from the committee? That we have two witnesses who wish to speak in their hand.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Just a brief question. Help me understand the logic of, I don't know what the percentage of people who sell a home every year, but I would imagine it's a minority number of people in the state. What is the logic that says that that group of people are the people that ought to pay the tax to support this? Why wouldn't this be something that would be more broadly based? I guess I'm just, help me to understand what the logic is to say that home sellers are the people that should bear the costs of the additional funding that you're proposing.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hahn, there are a couple of different reasons we chose this tax. The first is that we took a look at what other states across the country were doing when they were dedicating resources. And there are 10 other states that use the deed tax as a dedicated revenue source for affordable housing programs. The reason was stated earlier that housing market is able to, when homes are selling because the cost of homes are appreciation, which owners are getting the benefits of appreciating values of their homes, it makes it much more difficult for low-income people to afford to buy those homes or get into the rental market. And so in attaching the revenue source to the housing market, you're generating what would be the most appropriate amount of money for those who are struggling to either afford rental housing or get into home ownership.
Of all the ways we can make our money grow, housing equity is a significant one for a number of people. The legislation that has been passed over the years has really helped people not have to pay taxes on that appreciation. And so this small increase in the deed tax, to me, makes good business sense.
Further questions? If not, thank you all very much. I have Christine Berger and Susan Diori requesting speaking concerns about the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, for the record, my name is Susan Diori, and I do represent the Minnesota Association of Realtors. And as you might understand, we have 26,000 members in our association, so we have some that are not going to always agree with the position that we take formally. I do want to make a couple of points and respectfully speak in opposition to this proposal. First of all, from our members' perspective, the majority of our members, we believe that the legislature is going to be spending $53 billion in the next biennium. And within this $53 billion, we think the legislature should spend some time prioritizing on how that money should be spent within our current tax frame. In addition to that, I want to make a couple of other points. Sure. Yep. You mentioned here, you heard mentioned here earlier that the real estate market is in decline, and that I don't think anybody has ever claimed that this any particular tax is going to totally and completely wipe out the real estate industry, but certainly this does not help it. Hopefully you all received from me, from our association, a packet. We sent everyone a folder with a packet in it. It shows you a lot of graphs taken from a Moody's housing report showing you how much equity has been tapped out in certain areas of our state. Not only has a significant amount of equity been tapped out in our state, a lot of the mortgages that were taken out in the past couple of years were on adjustable rate mortgages, which $2 trillion worth is going to come due in the next 2 years. So we already have some urgency on housing issues, and I am a little offended. I do take pride in providing this legislature honest and accurate information, and I am a little offended that some of the proponents of this legislation have said that we have put out false information. We actually have run the numbers, and although they're going to talk to you about what's going to increase, what we put out to our realtor members is the actual amount that people will pay in the end of the day. So in the metropolitan area, the average sales price now is $275,000. Okay, that's the average sales price of a residential property. Under the current law, the total mortgage registry and deed tax, because we're going to have to pay both of these at time of closing, if you put 20% down on a house. This is using this assumption. The total mortgage registry deed tax to transfer property in Minnesota would be $1,413. Under the proposed deed tax increase, which is a 50% increase in the current deed tax, under this proposal, that same property under a 20% down mortgage would be paying $1,881 for total mortgage. And the other problem with this is that in addition to that, it could get higher in Hennepin and Ramsey if we have an environmental surcharge. So we are not putting out false information. The total amount that's going to be paid at the end of the day is significant, $2,000. This is a property tax. This is a tax on property. And to the degree that it's going to make housing less affordable, not more affordable. Particularly for those lower-end properties, because those lower-end properties turn over more frequently than do the upper-income properties. From a tax perspective, this is a regressive tax, and it's going to hurt because it's going to fall more heavily on the lower-income properties more frequently. We greatly appreciated listening to Senator Berglund's testimony about having people help themselves from a housing standpoint, particularly on the issue of affordable housing. We've seen study after study that clearly indicates that local impact fees have much more effect on the ability to obtain affordable housing in this state than any other factor. And so we have provided examples to the legislature on how some local units of government have charged impact fees. We've provided one example of impact fees up to over $50,000 on one residential property. And when we zone out people for one-acre lots and we have to have the brick front and the three-car garage and et cetera, and we can't build affordable housing, it's not going to exist. So, again, from our perspective, we believe that affordable housing issues should be dealt with not by making housing less affordable by increasing the tax upon it, but by addressing those other issues that are driving the cost of housing higher. And I appreciate the time to testify, and I'd like to stand for any questions.
Senator Worgen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if this is a comment or if there's a question in there, if Senator Cohen wants to respond to it or whatever, but in my area, and I would say across a great part of the state, there's a whole lot of people that are selling their homes for many reasons, whether it's the fact that they took out the ARM loans to begin with and all of a sudden their payment is what they can't afford, or if they purchased too large a house in the first place, or change of life circumstances, cost of gas, you name it. There's a lot of them for sale, and a tremendous amount of them in my area. And it's not as simple as it sounds. A lot of these people are having to sell their houses for what they owe on their mortgage, or in some cases even less than what they owe on their mortgage. And the people that are buying those houses are trying to get in them. And some people tend to think that realtors are rolling in the dough. In my area, in some cases, by the time they're finished with sharing the MLS listing, the rates and everything like that, they're down to like a 1.75 per commission. And they're selling less than one home a month because the market isn't very good for housing right now. So the realtor's not rolling in the dough. The seller doesn't have anything to give because they're selling the house for equity, for whatever they have left on the loan or even less. And we're going to add something then because it has to go someplace. We are, I think, in some ways making the cost of a house just a little bit less affordable for the next family that wants to get into the house. In some ways, it seems like we're creating a round robin, and I just can't see how this is helping. I've had wonderful conversations with Mr. Dahl, and we've found some great common ground on trying to figure out how to work with some homelessness, but I don't see how this particular bill takes care of that.
Senator Cohen, did you want to comment?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Wergen, let me offer a couple of perspectives and possibly a partial response to Ms. Diori. First of all, in terms of the issue you raise, one of the things that I have found very frustrating working on this issue over the last several years, with all respect, are comments like yours. And I don't mean that directed toward you personally, but what we hear from everybody in the legislature, the people involved with this legislation hear this, I hear it all the time. Oh, this is a real problem. We've got to take care of it. You're right. This is the way to do it, though. I hear that time and time again. I've tried to present a way to handle this to this committee, as I've done with other committees. We didn't have the bill up on the floor last year. And all I hear is, yeah, we've got to take care of the problem, not this way. So I guess I'm open to what the way is. And nobody else seems to have presented another alternative. Because obviously, if we're going to talk about X number of dollars in ongoing money for these purposes to the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, we're not going to take it away from K-12 education. Maybe, Senator Wergen, what your comments lead to, and I tend not to be one who shouts about this in the legislature. Mr. Chairman, you've been more outspoken than most, and people respect you for that. Maybe we need to take a look at the levels of taxation in the state because we do have some significant unmet needs. And maybe your comments lead us directly to that conclusion. Second, you talked in an anecdotal way about what's happening in your area in terms of a diminishment of market value. In fact, I had another bill in the Tax Committee this morning that deals with limited market value. We had some of the same conversation. Mr. Chairman, you shake your head, but I think what you're talking about is a housing market that maybe has become a difficult market. You talk about people who are selling their homes for basically just the mortgage or even less than that. I wanted to offer a couple of examples. I'll do my anecdotal stuff in addition to my district and having some of the same considerations. As a lawyer, I do a lot of dissolution practice. And I can talk to you about clients who are forced to sell homes and what happens in that situation. I also have my personal situation where I was looking to had looked at buying a home first part of the year, and there were reasons that it didn't go through. There was one particular home in mind. But I actually sat down with the realtor, and I hope I'm not going to identify the realtor, although he's a realtor who's worked for a lengthy period of time in my area. And we talked about, I said, well, now that I'm on the other end of it, where I might be selling and buying a home, how does this impact? And as we worked through the dollars, it was clear it didn't have much of an impact. And, in fact, his comment was that he had not responded to requests from the association to write or call me long prior to, and I've known this person for a long time, but long prior to his possibly working as a realtor, but somebody who's been a friend and a supporter of mine. He hadn't contacted me, and I asked him about that, and he said he thought that the legislation as introduced was workable in the context of what he does, how it would impact on people both buying and selling. And the last comment I would make is And this is more of a comment directed, if you allow me, Mr. Chairman, to the witness, to Mr. Diori. I think that I'm not sure how the committee views its jurisdiction. We could have a discussion about whether or not this is an appropriate level of a deed tax and whether it becomes too onerous. It seems to me that would be within the jurisdiction of the tax committee as opposed to this committee. And hopefully, Mr. Chairman, I'm not stepping out of line and suggesting committee jurisdiction so they don't serve on this committee. But when we get into a discussion of what level of tax, it seems to me that's within the tax committee.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Cohen, you asked for another solution. I've not objected to what the governor is doing, and I think he's taking a very honest step forward in looking at homelessness. He's proposed a substantial amount in his budget in this current biennium. And I actually think that that being shared by all taxpayers is more of a well-rounded solution to the whole issue. And I wasn't talking about diminishing property values. The property values are not diminishing in my area. I was just simply talking about selling a house for its value, but you did address that. You talk about solutions, and I know that homelessness is a problem. I know that it exists. Again, like I said, Mr. Dahl came in and did a wonderful conversation with me, and I appreciated his insight. But I still think the approach is better through the total budget than to put a deed tax on. And I think at a time, I still do believe, even though it may well seem like a small amount to a lot of people, it's not a good idea to make, basically, when you look at the population of Minnesota, to make a few people pay for the cost of homelessness.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Wergen, I'm very flattered in presenting the bill to your committee today because I saw Mr. Dorfman here and I hadn't seen him all year, and flattered that he would come back to the Capitol just for my bill. Having said that, you make Mr. Dorfman's point that should a particular part of the population pay, and if we can do something relative to the tax structure and expand revenues in this state, and you'll join me in that regard. Then maybe we can fund this in a different way.
Mr. Chair, I must respond to that. Mr. Chair, Senator Cohen, we have, we could get into a long discussion, and I'll try not to do that, but we, in fact, do have $1 billion on the bottom of this biennial budget to use for one-time spending. We do, in fact, have another $1 billion-plus dollars to use to put in the current budget. We also have program inflation, which already is in the current budget. I would agree with you that K-12 should be our first priority, but I don't think that we need to increase taxes to do this.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, has anyone moved the bill for Senator Cohen?
The bill has not been moved yet.
I'll do that.
Senator Berglund moves the bill.
And is it go to taxes next?
Mr. Chairman, I would suggest it goes to finance first, then to the tax committee.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
Mr. Chairman?
Wherever you want it to go.
Mr. Dahl, then Ms. Diori, then we've got several people over here.
Mr. Chair, and just a couple of points from Senator Wergen. First of all, I know that a number of you have been hearing about we're trying to get $100 million additional dollars into the Housing Finance Agency any way we can because we absolutely need it. And so if someone's going to help find that money in another way, we're willing to take a look at it. But it is a serious amount of money. I just want to point out as a homeowner that every year my taxes are reduced by $3,000 every year because of the mortgage interest deduction. There are tax benefits to home ownership that low-income people and low-income renters don't get. And this is saying that the point of sale for all of that benefit that you've received in the tax structure and also through the appreciation, my home in 6 years has doubled in value and I've done nothing to deserve that other than live in it, is that something, some small amount go back to help new people into the same opportunity that I have. And so I think if we're going to talk about tax structure, we need to talk about that there are tremendous tax benefits to home ownership, and this is a small way to bring some equity for those that aren't able to afford that benefit.
Mr. Chair, to that point first, unfortunately, only 30% of Minnesotans actually file deductions. And for that poor widow who's going to sell her property so she can go into the nursing home, she doesn't itemize. So she doesn't get any sort of deduction. But, you know, to Senator Cohen's point about whether, you know, whether this committee should be discussing the tax and the rate, I do think it is the purview of this committee to at least talk about what is the definition of affordable housing. It was stated earlier in testimony that that we were misinforming the legislature that this doesn't that this covers people under 115% of median family income. It does. If you see Section 5, Subdivision 4 of this bill, money from this proposal will go to people who make 115% of median family income. And that is upwards of $80,000 in the metropolitan area. The other question I think that this committee needs to consider is how much we're currently spending for homeless initiatives. We've asked this question numerous times from the federal, state, and local levels. How much are we spending? And I think this committee should be asking that question and determine what we are spending, how it's being spent, before we talk about creating more burdens on a select few taxpayers and burdening buyers and sellers when they go to transfer their property.
Ms. Diori, I would suggest that if you take a tour with Mr. Dahl and some others of some of the homeless shelters and so on, your answer would probably be we're not spending enough on addressing homelessness. Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Cohen, I just wanted to let you know that I am supporting you 100%, and I believe that you're absolutely right. We need to talk about how are we going to take care of education, health care, and homelessness. And sometimes this demands that we sit down and really make some tough decisions. I have asked many of my neighbors in South Minneapolis, and I asked myself. I bought my house 10 years ago for $80,000. And I'm thinking about I may sell it for $275,000. I have made a lot of money in my house. And the reason I made a lot of money in the house is because there was a lot of investment in housing in my area. So I believe that I can pay $400. And I have asked all my neighbors, would you be willing to pay $400? Because that's the average home in my block and down the block. And they said, we will be glad to pay $400. These are homeowners. And that's why at the beginning of the meeting, I asked if we could disclose if the people here are realtors. Because I have asked homeowners who will actually be paying the bill. And they have said yes to me. So I am here to deliver that message to you from my constituents that they have acquired equity in their homes and they are willing to pay $400 so that we can improve living in the city and throughout the state of Minnesota.
Senator Hahn.
I thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess a couple of points. I think Ms. Diori's question about how much money we do spend, where it goes, what it's being used for is a good one. I think it would be worth having testimony or some explanation of all the things that we do for affordable housing, homelessness, and look at that more closely. Second, I think that Senator Wergen's point is well taken, that we do have a lot of money in the budget that we have that we didn't have 4 years ago. We have a surplus. I think our challenge is to look at what are the priorities that we're going to take and where the investments we think would make the most sense. I find it difficult to support an increase in taxation on a relatively small number of people. I think if we want to devote money to homelessness, which is a good thing to do, let's do it in a way that is more general and put it in the list of priorities with everything else that we're discussing. And so, Mr. Chairman, I think this bill would be good to have a roll call vote on, and I'd like to request a roll call vote.
Senator Hahn requests a roll call vote on the Berglund motion. Further discussion from members of the committee.
Wait, where's Michelle?
A couple members missing right now.
Oh, go get
her. Thank you. By the way, Ms. Berger, I assume, did not wish to testify. Is there further discussion while we're waiting for a couple people? Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, I have a request for Ms. Diori. Would you email to all of those people who emailed us and tell them to stop And if they haven't emailed us, tell them not to email us, because my email is the Senate email system is clogged with the same exact email from way too many people. So would you put the word out that they?
I'd also point out it was called a property tax many times, and I suppose you could, and Ms. Diori said it's a tax on property. In that case, you could call a sales tax a property tax, too, because it's a tax on personal property. But I think a lot of the issues here relate to some semantics. But, was Senator Erickson Ropes? I don't know where she is. Okay. Is there any further discussion? If not, clerk will take the roll on the Berglund motion that Senate File 442 be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Finance.
Senator Marty?
Aye.
Senator Berglund?
Aye.
Senator Dahl?
Aye.
Senator Erickson Ropes? Senator Fischbach?
No.
Senator Hahn?
No.
Senator Higgins?
Yes.
Senator Johnson?
No.
Senator Coring?
No.
Senator Lori?
Aye.
Senator Lynch?
Aye.
Senator Pretner Solon?
Aye.
Senator Torres Ray?
Aye.
Senator Wergen?
No.
Senator Erickson Ropes?
Yes.
By a vote of 9 in favor and 5 opposed, the motion does prevail.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, members, thank you very much.
We have to be out of here in 10 minutes, and I don't know if any of the remaining people have very, very quick bills. Senator Berglund has a very, very quick bill.
I have a quick one, too.
Senator Moi, is your bill very quick?
Very quick.
She's, Senator Berglund, she's not on the committee, so we'll let her go first. And you can both get sit at the table, and I will ask that the people leaving, thank you for coming, but please be quiet when you leave because we do want to conduct business for the next couple minutes.
Mr. Chair, do you know when the bills are going to be heard that weren't here heard today?
We will perhaps Friday. We'll
Friday,
get in
maybe?
Touch with you right after the hearing. Senator Moi, welcome to the committee. Senate File.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's a pleasure to be in this room and in front of this committee. This is my first time in front of this committee, and I'm very honored to be here. Mr. Chair and members, Senate File 1052 is an opportunity for donors to affordable housing projects to get a tax credit. The affordable housing donor credits are intended to leverage state investments in affordable housing by encouraging charitable donations. The state would provide a 50% credit for contributions to Minnesota Housing Fund, Minnesota Housing Funded Affordable Projects or Programs. The credits can be awarded for donations for ownership or rental housing or for programs like the Family Homeless Prevention. The credits are available to corporations or individuals, but the maximum credit for a taxpayer is $250,000. The minimum credit is $5,000 for a donation of $10,000, and the credits for a taxpayer may not exceed taxes paid, but may be carried forward for a maximum of 5 years. Under the proposal, the state would make $5 million available for donor credits. Charitable donations may be cash, land, construction materials, and marketable securities. And in the bill, we have up to at least $1,000. And, Mr. Chair, I would like to do a oral amendment to change that from $1,000 to $10,000.
Senator Torres Ray moves on page, what page is it on?
Page 1.
Page 1.
Line 23.
Line 23. Moves to strike 1,000 and insert 10,000. On that motion, any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair and members, once the contribution has been made, the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency will provide certificates certifying the amount of the credit, and we'll be working with the Department of Revenue. The donor credit programs, like the one proposed here, have been used in other states to encourage business participation in housing development or rehabilitation and employer-assisted housing programs in rural and urban areas. Mr. Chair, members, I ask for your support of Senate File 1052. I have here with me Mr. Chip Hallbuck, who was prepared to testify, but in the interest of time, he could answer any questions that you might have.
Questions from the committee. Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Moy, I just think, particularly with respect to the last bill, here's another alternative that would be helpful. I'm just wondering what the expected qualifying contributions would this bill generate. We're estimating what kind of result this would have, what kind of impact it would have in the affordable housing marketplace. I know I'm not sure.
Mr. Hallbuck, welcome to the committee.
Yes, thank you. I'm Chip Hallbuck with Minnesota Housing Partnership. We're a nonprofit organization that works mostly in rural communities to help communities address affordable housing needs. But I believe the legislation proposes a $5 million state investment in tax credit. And that, in turn, would leverage, so $10 million of donations. So what can you get for $10 million? And it really varies because most of this funding would be put into much larger projects where other types of resources would come in. So I would believe that you would have maybe 30, 40 affordable housing undertakings, maybe 8 units apiece, that would benefit from an investment of this size.
Thank you.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, Senator Moy or Mr. Hallbeck, I'm thinking about a lot of the boarded buildings that we have around especially the metro area right now. Could the mortgage company or the owner or whoever has title to them donate them to a nonprofit organization, for example, and get the tax credit and then get the house back in the market?
Yes, Senate, Mr. Chair, Senator. And very briefly, in talking to people around the state about uses for this program, on the Iron Range, they're talking about the immense number of jobs coming into the area and also the potential displacement, and looking at some of these big companies coming in using this credit to help create more housing there. Also, Habitat for Humanity has talked about this in terms of the large inflation and cost there, in that their resources are very stretched, so it's very important to have a donor-based resource like this to bring in more funds. But specifically to your point, also Jim Urchell from Dayton's Bluff neighborhood on the east side of St. Paul identified that he would believes in conversations with some of the banks, not the outside investors that own some of these foreclosed and boarded homes, but some of the local banks would be willing to take a deep discount in turning over those homes to a local community development corporation so that then they can be fixed up and put back into the market. And Mr. Urchell believes that this resource would facilitate that happening.
Okay, I vote yes.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Worgen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Moy, I just wanted to echo Senator Hand's thank you for coming up with something creative besides a tax increase.
Mr. Chair, members, this bill has been in the Senate for a number of years, and I'm, you know, very pleased to have such enthusiastic response to this alternative this year.
Senator Higgins moves Senate File 1052 as amended be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Taxation.
That's right.
Further discussion of that motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that, Senator Bergen, we have a committee coming in here right at 3 o'clock. Is yours 1 minute or less, you think?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the last bill that I have up today is a bill that deals with the legislative auditor's recommendation on county services. It is... Joel Alter is here to answer any questions you have about it, but essentially the report asked Department of Human Services and counties to look at whether counties could be grouped to provide services better, and if the state took over certain services that they are now doing, if that might not be more efficient. This would just be a study to look at those issues.
And Senator Berglund, you have the A1 amendment?
I do. It would allow individuals who are not working for the county or the state to be on the advisory committee.
Senator Berglund moves the A1 amendment. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevailed. Any discussion on the bill or questions from Mr. Alter?
I'd move then that amendment? Senate file 1178 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance.
There is another amendment, but you can have to deal with that in finance. sorry. Discussion on the Berglund motion. If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Members of the committee, we will adjourn this and then reconvene for the joint hearing in 5 minutes.